Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, September 22, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome return guest Adam White. He's going to act as our moderator and introduce the other panelists as well. Mr. White is a research fellow at the Hoover Institution right here in Washington, D.C., and a longtime member and supporter of the Federalist Society. Adam White, welcome back. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks, everybody, for joining today's call, and thanks to our speakers. I'll introduce in just a moment. Before a cabinet meeting in January 2014, President Obama famously described his approach to regulation going forward into the final 2 years of his second term. He said, quote, "We are not just going to be waiting for legislation in order to make sure that we're providing Americans the kind of help that they need. I've got a pen and I've got a phone." Needless to say, His description of his approach and the way that this played out in terms of regulation has sparked no shortage of controversy among his critics and enthusiasm among his supporters. But in today's call, we thought we would take a more detailed and specific look at the regulations that his administration has produced in recent years, and looking ahead to the final months of his term, the quote midnight regulations might be promulgated by agencies in the administration's closing days. And for this discussion, we have with us today two experts who have both published recently papers and analyses of these topics. First, we have Sam Batkins. Sam is Director of Regulatory Policy at the American Action Forum, where he researches and writes on the rulemaking efforts of administrative agencies and on Congress. His articles have appeared in the Wall Street Journal and other prominent publications, and he has testified before the Senate, House, and state legislatures across the country. And today we'll be discussing his recent study of the Obama administration's pace of rulemaking, titled 600 Major Regulations, which, if I understand correctly, is a sequel to a study last year titled 500 Major Regulations. Our second speaker will be Sophie E. Miller. She's a senior policy analyst at the George Washington University's Regulatory Studies Center, where she analyzes the effects of federal regulations. Her research portfolio includes the use of benefit-cost analysis by agencies, retrospective review of existing rules, economic analysis of agency efficiency standards, quantitative analysis of regulatory benefits, and the regressive effects of regulation. Drawing on this research, Sophie regularly testifies before Congress, submits comments to agencies, and publishes articles in academic journals and magazines. And I should add, she edits the Regulatory Studies Center's weekly email newsletter, Regulation Digest, which I'll say is really indispensable. And today we'll be discussing the article that she recently co-authored with Daniel Perez, titled "The Final Countdown, Projecting Midnight Regulations." So first, if you will, Sam, on 600 major regulations.
Sure. Thanks so much, Adam. You mentioned our initial report last year, which was 500 major regulations, and I think we sort of stumbled upon that just because it happened to be a round number, but we then quickly realized that 500 major regulations was more than what President Bush had done in 8 years. So in 6.5 years, you know, President Obama essentially equaled the regulatory output of President Bush in 8 years. And that's an extra year and a half of regulation, obviously, and this is despite the reality that the President Bush's tenure was not a time for, I think, severe deregulation, as much as you occasionally hear that trope around Washington, D.C. about financial deregulation. But, I mean, you have to consider that under President Bush's tenure, we had major regulations addressing 9/11 security concerns, the implementation of Sarbanes-Oxley, and I'm sure, as Sophie will highlight, a pretty active midnight period as well, including some major regulations to address the financial crisis there late in 2008. But we thought a year later, it would take a while to go from 500 to 600, and we thought that wouldn't be the case until maybe around election time. But you have to consider that from July of last year to July of this year, they added 91 rules, major rules, between that period. And the president is roughly on pace to add 90 major rules in 2016, which would be the third highest total on record and the second highest for a lame duck year, the highest being in 2010, where if you just look at calendar year, there were 100 major rules added. And just to put things in perspective, because I know that 600 is just a big round number, more or less, but it's about 20% more than what President Bush did in 8 years. And if you look at the pace, and again, I think Sophie will get into what we're on pace for during the lame duck period, we could easily hit 650 major rules. We're technically, as of today, just checking this morning, we're up to 627 this year, which is about obviously significantly more than what President Bush did. And if you take a look back historically, and we have a bit of a sample from the last few years of President Clinton, if you look back in the late 90s, we were on track for about 50 to 60 major rules on average, and we've since increased that up to around 80 major rules on average. And it's not that surprising, but I was at a panel in the spring, and there was someone there from a progressive think tank, and he sort of nodded with approval. You know, 20 to 30% more than President Bush sounds about right. To other people, this was after the panel. They had said that they wished it would be 40 or 50% more than President Bush. So I guess it depends on how subjective you view regulation and the impact of regulation as to whether or not the totals over President Bush are significant or just sort of what you would expect from a Democratic administration. And I think broadly, if you want to take a look back at the historical record of President Obama, it's sort of strange because I feel like both progressives and conservatives bemoan the regulatory state in similar ways and also in different ways. Progressives are upset about regulatory delay and sometimes even output, and conservatives are more or less just concerned with the output. Yet for all the talk of regulatory delay and regulatory ossification and how the system is broken, President Obama is going to average roughly a major rule every 3 days. So every 3 days that the government is open. And if the system were hopelessly broken in terms of ossification, I think we wouldn't be able to achieve that level of production necessarily. And I don't want to get too much into the future, but we're up to 627 major rules now in terms of broadly what's on track. There are, I think you'll see a few more energy efficiency rules coming down in the next few months, and this has been a priority for the Obama administration. He's already concluded review of 30 economically significant DOE rulemakings, again, with three under review now. And for comparison, I think that this might be the most surprising thing that I think I came across in this research. But from 1993 to 2009, both President Clinton and President Bush finalized just five significant DOE measures. So it's a six-fold increase on the energy efficiency front from President Obama, and I think that's something that doesn't necessarily get a ton of coverage in the future, or that hasn't gotten a ton of coverage, pardon me. In terms of maybe what else specific rules that people are interested in that might be coming, the renewable fuel standard is set to be final during the lame duck period, as is the vehicle-to-vehicle communications requirement. There's already been advance notice of proposed rulemaking on that front. But that was supposed to be final in May, so that's something that I think we could see at any moment now. But in terms of specific output and expectations for the lame duck period, I know Sophie's research has model and predictions on that front.
Sam, just a quick question. What's the data set that you're drawing on for this study? Where did you get these numbers?
Sure. These are all from the Government Accountability Office, which comes with the caveat that there's usually a pretty big lag in the data. This is GAO relies more or less on agencies to report major rules to them. And I think we came across recently one major rule that had a lag of a year and a half or a year. So there was a major rule that was published, I think, in 2013. And GAO didn't get it until the end of 2014. So, but it all relies on GAO's report of major rules, which we try to mirror on our website, RegRodeo.com, every Monday we take the list of all the major rules for the year, and we'll make sure that those are uploaded to our website as well.
That's great. So the website is regrodeo.com?
Correct, correct. Great. And if you could go and see all, you know, there's a tag for major rules.
And I don't mean to put you on the spot because I didn't ask you this question in advance, but do you know if the GAO numbers included the rules from independent agencies? Because I know they don't submit theirs to OIRA for oversight, and oftentimes they don't do cost-benefit analysis on their own if they're not required to by statute. Do you know if this data set included independent agencies?
They do. They do include independent agencies, even though oftentimes I'm curious of the person who actually writes these reports for GAO, but GAO has to just note that, you know, generally no benefit cost analysis was conducted by the independent agencies. So, but independent agencies are included in the total.
You mentioned a few rules, sort of high profile examples, and again, not to put you on the spot, but I'm just curious, is there one particular rule that sort of jumped out at you as sort of surprising or interesting that hasn't gotten as much attention as it probably should have?
Well, I mentioned, I think broadly, the energy efficiency standards, because I know that has been an effort by President Obama to address greenhouse gas emissions. And at a separate project, we're sort of looking at DOE and EPA regulations and maybe what a regulation-only approach to greenhouse gas standards would look like in the future. And it's sort of surprising because, I know Sophie has done some research into this, that the average DOE rulemaking, despite the pretty significant costs, only reduced about 4 million tons of CO2 annually, which is, you know, when you take into context what we're producing yearly, it's not that much. A lot of the savings don't come from greenhouse gas emissions from DOE rulemakings. They come from, you know, the consumer savings that the DOE anticipates. But, you know, that's an area, if you told people that one agency was going to have a six-fold increase in significant regulation over the both President Bush and President Clinton, I think people would view that as surprising. You don't see sort of similar increases from DOE or Department of Labor. I mean, there are increases, but not to that magnitude.
That's interesting. Well, thanks, Sam. And I'll come back with more questions in a bit. But now I'd like to turn to Sophie to talk about her study, which is available on the Regulatory Studies Center's website. It's called The Final Countdown, Projecting Midnight Regulations. And again, it's co-authored by Sophie and by Daniel Perez. And I should say up front, I encourage you to look up the report because in addition to Sophie's analysis, it's heavily footnoted. So it will point you to many other resources on midnight regulations, which, you know, every 4 years or every 8 years becomes, you know, an issue of much greater interest. And so I highly encourage you to read the report. Sophie, why don't you tell us what you found in your report, and also if you could just try to offer a general description of what midnight regulations are. I'm sure the audience will appreciate that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Adam, for introducing our report that Daniel Perez and I co-authored, and also many thanks to you, Sam, for laying the groundwork for all of my favorite topics, including energy efficiency standards, midnight regulations, and just general trends in rulemaking. So that's a real pleasure to hear from you. I hope to build off of this in a useful way. So let's just start off with midnight regulations. Those are regulations that are typically finalized at the very end of a presidential administration. And the theory is that, you know that there's a new administration coming in with new regulatory priorities. So agencies want to finish the work that they've already begun. You know, these are their pet projects, things they've been working on for a long time. They're trying to get that out the door. So we typically do see a pretty big increase in rulemaking activity in those last final months of a presidential administration, or as we did in the Bush administration, to see it spread out sort of throughout the final year. So our goal with this paper was to identify, well, it was to answer two questions, really. It was to answer, is there a statistically significant increase in rulemaking activity during these final months? And that was a historical analysis that we did using a regression model. And then we also wanted to know, okay, we've got this historical data on rulemaking activity, and we've also got data from the Obama administration on how actively he's been regulating, which, as Sam explained, in some ways really does exceed past trends in rulemaking. And if we can combine those data, how can we project what kind of regulatory activity we're likely to see during the midnight period? So let's see. We found, this may not surprise anyone if this is an issue that you follow, but we did find a statistically significant increase in major rules after the November presidential election and before the next president is sworn in, which is typically considered the traditional midnight period. So, for example, on average, President Obama's agencies have issued just over 4 economically significant rules per month. And our models predict that the number will increase about threefold, so to 12 economically significant rules per month between November to January 2017. And if these predictions are accurate, and these predictions, of course, build off of historical data, then that adds up to the issuance of at least $1.2 billion in regulatory effects on the economy per month during the midnight period. So if you're wondering why you should care about an increase in regulatory activity, it's something to keep in mind. This has a large economic impact. Whether you think that's bad or good is, you know, you don't need to get into it, but it makes a big difference. It makes a big policy difference what happens in these agencies at the end of a presidential administration. Now, one finding that was really interesting and something that my colleague Daniel Perez focused on is that this increase in regulation is really only true for executive branch agencies, such as EPA, Department of Labor. Now, when we're looking at independent regulatory agencies like the CFPB and the SEC, they historically haven't really shown as much of a surge in midnight regulation. And this can tell us about, for instance, the structure or about how they're structured, because, for example, their commissioners don't all change after a new president is sworn in. So maybe their incentives are different. They don't have this incentive to rush their regulations after the election. One thing that I think is really interesting is that because our report builds off of historical data, it doesn't include the CFPB because it wasn't created yet during the last presidential administration. So I'm really curious to know, will this trend hold true now that we have this very active regulator in the independent agency sphere? And that's something that will give us new data to look at the next time around if we want to be making these projections as well. So I mentioned the size. These are huge rules, right? And the regulatory process is really important here because the rules that are these last-minute rushed rules tend to be the biggest ones, economically significant or major rules that agencies expect will have an impact of $100 million or more per year. That's not just in general, but per year. So in addition to the onslaught of these new rules, one reason that people are concerned about them and why they can be problematic is because in the past, midnight regulations have been tied to less thorough analysis, which is a really important part of the rulemaking process, of course, along with fewer opportunities for the public to participate in the rulemaking process. And we know that both of these things, you know, rigorous analysis and public input, they're both really important building blocks for a healthy regulatory process. And if you shortcut these important inputs, it's possible it could lead to worse regulatory outcomes. So not to get too quantitative, because I know that I'm not a lawyer here. I'm an economist. I'll try not to make your eyes glaze over. But one of the important findings that I had in my probabilistic model was a projection that agencies will issue 60 economically significant rules from now until a new president is sworn in January. So remember that each of those economically significant rules has an annual impact of $100 million or more per year. So that's at least $6 billion in annual regulatory impact squeezed just into 5 short months. So while the costs and benefits of those rules are initiated during the Obama administration, their effect is going to be continue to be felt during the next presidential administration and beyond and beyond and beyond. So in comparison to previous administrations, because the Obama administration has issued more economically significant rules on average, we expect that to continue during the midnight period as well. So if we're drawing on historical data, which we are, our model predicts a high likelihood, so greater than 70% likelihood, that executive agencies are going to issue more economically significant rules during Obama's midnight period than his recent predecessors did. So more than George W. Bush, George H.W. Bush, and more than Clinton. So for example, I had mentioned that I'm predicting around 60 economically significant rules between now and January. And in comparison, for H.W. Bush, Clinton, and Bush, they each issued 41, 45, and 49 economically significant rules during the same time period, respectively. So it's a pretty big jump. But I'll go back and caveat, though, that these models are built off of historical data. And so we're using what's happened in the past to project into the future for the Obama midnight period. But as we get closer to the election, it's worth noting that the historical midnight periods included in the report's database, that might differ from the Obama administration's forthcoming midnight period in one really important way. So the data that I'm drawing from was presidential transitions from one party to a different party. And we see a lot of regulatory activity in those contexts. But if we're seeing an intra-party administration transition, that change may be different. I think we've seen in the past that there still is a midnight period and there still is increased regulatory activity, but it's to a different extent. And so if that happens, it will be interesting to watch from a data standpoint and say, in what ways does this differ from what we've seen in the past for different types of party transitions? So I'll wrap up there just to make sure that we have plenty of time for discussion. But I look forward to telling you all of the nitty-gritty details about this quantitative probabilistic model that I'm sure everybody just really wants to discuss after lunch. So if you've got any questions, lob them at me.
Well, thanks, Sophie. Let me offer a couple of questions and before we turn to the audience. And first, you talked about the interplay between the outgoing administration and an incoming administration, and of course that's affected by whether it's an inter-party change or an intra-party change. I'm just curious, what could a subsequent president do to change or modify the midnight regulations that are left behind by his or her predecessor?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of people are very interested in that process right now. And what I can say is that your options are fairly limited unless there are midnight regulations that haven't been published yet. So if you've got some that, for instance, are waiting for review at OIRA, or if they have been sent to the Federal Register but not published yet, then you have a few more options. So, for example, you can withdraw final rules that haven't been published yet in the Federal Register. You can put a stop on finalizing any new rules and publishing them before they've been signed off on by the new administration. And you can also delay the effective date of rules that haven't been published yet. But these are, you know, those are kind of smaller tweaks. I'm sure they have an effect, but they're smaller tweaks. Once you have rules that are finalized, your options are much more limited. So you've got, of course, the Congressional Review Act, which has only been successfully used one time, or you've got other tactics such as watching how things play out in the courts. For example, we know the Clean Power Plan and WOTUS will both be litigated in the next administration. And if the next administration is not a big fan of those rules, then it will probably affect how vigorously they defend them in court.
Well, and about Congressional Review Act, could you just walk us through really briefly what it is, how it works, and how it might apply at the end of this administration?
Sure. So the Congressional Review Act gives Congress the authority to pass a binding resolution of disapproval for a major rule. And what that does is if the president signs it, because, of course, it needs the president's signature, then it prevents that rule from going into effect, and it also prevents the agency from finalizing any or issuing a rule that is substantially the same as that. So it's a very powerful tool. It tells the agency, this isn't what we wanted, and you can't try to do something that is mostly the same but just a little bit different. So it's a powerful tool, but it's only the last time it's been used effectively was in, I think, 2001, and that was for the OSHA ergonomic standard. And since then, we haven't seen I don't predict that there will be a lot of use of the CRA that is successful at this next administration transition, but I'll of course be keeping my eye out because it will be historical when it happens, only the second time.
Well, thanks, Sophie. Dean, would you like to just reiterate the directions on how to queue up for questions, and then I'll ask another question or two and we can turn it over?
Sure. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you need to push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we go to our questions, we don't have any questions yet. Our lines are wide open. Let me make a quick announcement about our upcoming schedule. Tomorrow at 2 p.m., we'll be discussing Midnight Monuments, late-term designations by the President of National Monuments, sometimes involving very large swaths of land. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. If you have a question today, though, on regulations, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Adam, we've got one caller queued up so far.
Sure. Why don't we go right ahead and take the call?
Okay.
Yes, this question is for Sophie again. And following up on Adam's last question, did I take your answer? I just want to make sure I understood it correctly. And I took it to mean that there really is effectively no rollback that can be accomplished of these regulations, even though it's executive authority that arguably I always thought was tethered to a policy position and a policy preference and exercisable at the will of the successor president. And if it didn't comport with what his policy agenda was or preference, that it could be summarily, you know, not, I'm using the word inarticulately, I know, but repealed in effect.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think a lot of people are surprised that you can't snap your fingers and get rid of regulation. But the fact is that a lot of them are here to stay, and it's fairly difficult to remove rules. One option is, for example, say you've got a final rule and it sets standards that the next administration doesn't like, but it's already published as final before the next administration gets into office. Well, they can't pull it back from the Federal Register. It's already been published. They can't withdraw it from OIRA because it's already been reviewed. But what they can do is they can start over the rulemaking process from scratch. And they can say, okay, we're going to initiate a rulemaking. We are going to create a docket. We're going to write another proposed rule that repeals the last one and explains why and also details what the new policy will be, and then collect public comment on it through the notice and comment process, you know, submit to OIRA if it's necessary, and then finalize and encounter any resulting litigation that could occur. So there are options for creating new regulatory policies, but it can be very time consuming. As many of us know who follow the rulemaking process, making rules does take a long time. Agencies often are juggling multiple priorities, and so they can take years. We're not going to see a snap your fingers and things will immediately change kind of process. There are options that are available, but because our rulemaking process has so many important checks and balances built into it, those rollbacks won't happen overnight. They will take a long time.
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking. Was given the enormity of this aggressive action here, how often have you seen that practice availed of in the past? As far as, like you say, initiating a whole new process, but the process is really an effort to simply do what you couldn't accomplish through snapping your fingers, but it still is the normal procedure that would most often, or more conventionally, be utilized in reversing course.
That's a good question. I'm not sure of specifics on frequency, but I do know that when it happens, there can be litigation because what you're doing is you are changing course, and then there are some requirements from that the courts have deemed to be relevant about what justifications are appropriate for doing so. And if there, you know, it's Sam, since you're, I think, a lawyer, if you want to weigh in on what some of those requirements are, I encourage you to do so. But I plead economic ignorance of this.
Sure. Well, I mean, I just say broadly that the next administration has to have generally a good reason and can't just pull it back arbitrarily and capriciously. But if you look at, President Obama obviously had regulations when he entered that that he didn't like, legacy regulations from President Bush. And I will say, sort of broadly, anything that is an executive order or an executive action can be pulled back relatively quickly. And what we didn't see when President Obama and Democrats came in 2009 was a bunch of Congressional Review Act resolutions. They didn't utilize that, probably because, as Sophie mentioned, the rule may not be reissued in substantially the same form, which more or less means that, for example, the ergonomics rule, which was repealed back in 2001, means that essentially, unless Congress gives you new permission, the effect of this is that unless Congress gives you permission to do a whole new rulemaking, that rulemaking strain is effectively dead. So if you, I think it might be instructive to look back at sort of what President Obama did, and a lot of what they did was sort of undo a lot of the executive actions and executive orders of President Bush. And also, because President Obama had a Congress to work with, he was able to use basically legislative powers to undo some of what President Bush did. And of course, that's always an option for the next president if they don't like what President Obama has done. Technically, the easiest way to do it is just to pass a law. Obviously, that's not easy. But to some extent, if you have the votes, it's easier than navigating the regulatory process and then dealing with lawsuits. And I think everyone's big example is the Clean Power Plan. What could the next president do on that front? But if the courts uphold the Clean Power Plan, there's probably little, if anything, especially during the next 4 years, the next president will be able to do to undo the Clean Power Plan.
Is economic impact enough to surpass the arbitrary and capricious hurdle, for instance, or would that be considered whimsical?
You mean the economic impact, the Clean Power Plan being big enough that that just repealing it because you don't like it?
Like an end run around what was going to be cap and trade, but and notwithstanding that, which I know that again, it's a policy preference, but since we're in the policy realm, I was thinking that's, like you say, you still have to fall within the ambit of what isn't arbitrary and capricious, but if economic impact right on its face is something that is so significant, would that be enough to be able to overcome that?
Well, I think one problem you might run into is that we already did analyze the economic impact, and the agency decided that was something that they were willing to accept as the price for policy action. And I think one thing that, if memory serves, courts have found difficult to accept is an agency doing an about-face and saying, we were comfortable with that economic impact, and now all of a sudden we aren't anymore because it's a new administration. So I think you would have to have a more developed rulemaking record than that. But I'll caveat that as a non-lawyer, this is just my memory from administrative law courses.
Dean, do we have any other questions lined up now?
We do have one question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's now take our second question of the day.
I'm wondering, what is the actual framework for controlling the economic impact of a rule? Are there no limits, such as maximum amounts, or do you look to the statute? If the president wants to go ahead and issue an executive order, is he free to simply do so regardless of the economic impact?
So yes, in general, we have to analyze that economic impact if it passes a certain threshold, and that's the $100 million per year threshold there, where the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs will be analyzing that rulemaking as well to see what the impact is. So we do have some checks and balances built into the rulemaking process once rules pass a certain threshold, but there isn't a limit right now on how much economic impact a certain rule or a certain agency is allowed to account for over a certain period of time. Now, there are some reforms that would change that. For example, any type of regulatory budget that could be enacted might put a cap on how much economic impact agencies are permitted to incur in a certain time period, be it a year, 5 years, 2 calendar years, or anything like that. So there are some reforms that would change that. But right now, there isn't an overall cap on how much impact these rules or these agencies can incur. Do you have anything to add, Sam? I know that you've worked on regulatory budget issues.
Yeah, but I would just say on the executive order front, and whether or not there's an upward limit. Obviously, right now there isn't a regulatory budget. But just for some context, I think it was just this week that OIRA discharged its rule for paid sick leave for contractors, which was a result of President Obama's executive order, and it met the economically significant threshold. So it's any day it'll be published. But there's several among those lines that have happened recently. There's also the executive order for, I think it was, overtime rule for contractors. And I don't think it was a formal executive order, but earlier this year they formalized the general overtime expansions. But you're right that nothing now can sort of limit the economic significance. This is something that agency has to deal with once it gets and has to implement the executive order from the president.
Adam, we do have another audience question. I'm sorry.
Since we're talking about costs and benefits, I would like to just pause for a second and pose the one other question I had for both of our speakers. It has to do with the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, OIRA, the sort of cost-benefit czars inside of the White House Office of Management and Budget. I know this doesn't go directly to the things that you study in your papers, but you're both savvy followers of the executive branch and the way things work in the regulatory process there. And I'm just curious, as you looked back at the regulatory output of this administration, did you notice anything about the interplay between OIRA and the agencies? Because if I recall correctly, the OIRA's first administrator in this administration, Cass Sunstein, was widely seen as much more stringent on cost-benefit analysis than some of his successors might have been, or he was much more of seen as a fan of using cost-benefit analysis to trim back regulations by the agencies. Was any of this reflected in the data that you saw, or is that really just more impressionistic views that weren't borne out by the facts?
I mean, I think that the current administrator, Howard Schlansky, would definitely say that he's a fan of cost-benefit analysis. And of course, Cass Sunstein was as well. But one thing that I remember during his confirmation hearings, and I remember one of the early pledges that, again, this is outside of the scope of the research that we discussed, but Administrator Schlansky talked about how he would like to cut back on review times and move the process through a little bit more expeditiously. But if you were to look at overall OIRA review times from the 80s, 90s, and then today, it's still a pretty steady upward trend. I mentioned that vehicle-to-vehicle communication rule. That's been at the White House since January. So there still are rules that extend beyond this roughly 90-day timeline that's laid out in Executive Order 12866. So on that front, I think the review time is still relatively high. One change, I guess you could say, is that Cass Sunstein somewhat famously issued the only and first return letter that OIRA has issued during the Obama administration. That was for ozone, I think back in 2011, right around Labor Day time, probably Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock. Mm-hmm. But that was the only return letter. And, of course, that netted a lot of progressive outrage, given the nature of a clean air regulation. Administrator Schlansky has yet to do that. And it's something that if you were to just play around on OIRA's website, which is something I'm sure all of us do on a daily basis, you would find, because you can track the overall number of withdrawn rules or rules returned. And they went from a lot in even the 80s, 90s, and early aughts to, obviously, we haven't had a single return during Administrator Schlansky's tenure and just one during Cass Sunstein's tenure. So, you know, to some extent, I don't know, there's a huge difference between Sunstein Schlansky at the 30,000 foot level, but you have seen review times still somewhat higher than I think some people might want them to be, and you have seen the absence of that sort of very bold return letter strategy.
And one thing to build off of that is important to keep in mind is that we have a lot of rules that do go through OIRA, and they're big rules that need a lot of analysis, and yet the OIRA staff is very small and has been shrinking over time, while, you know, staffing at agencies where they're submitting all of these regulations has been increasing. So I think it has been difficult for them to keep up, and if they had, you know, another 10 analysts, I think it would be especially around the midnight time, perhaps, it would be a great boon to them. But one thing that I've seen at OMB that affects midnight regulation, so in the Bush administration, there was the Bolton memo. So OMB issued a memo telling agencies, all right, we're going to try to avoid this midnight rush. We recognize that midnight regulation is a thing. So if you want to get your rule in by the end of this administration, you need to finalize it by November 1st. And that was one way that OIRA was having a role in the influx of rules at the end of the administration. What's interesting is that Schlansky has done the same thing. So in January, well, not quite the same, but still recognizing that there can be this surge in regulations at the end of an administration. So in January, Schlansky issued a memo instructing agencies to stay to the timelines for their rules that were published in the Unified Agenda. So telling them, okay, whatever you said that you were going to do, that's what we're going to do. Try not to go off path. Let's keep this contained. So we do see that there are some similarities. They recognize that this is an issue and want to address that with agencies so we can avoid any problems later down on the line.
Great. Dean, you said we had another question queued up?
We do have one question at this point. If you would like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Now let's take another call.
Hi. Thanks for the call today. Just a couple of thoughts. I do most of my work in healthcare, and I know that I remember that the Clinton administration dropped the HIPAA privacy rule at the end of December in 2000, and then the George W. Bush administration pretty promptly, I think it was the end of March of 2001, adopted an interim final rule that made significant changes to the to the Clinton rule, made it a lot, simplified it quite a bit. There is the interim final rule that can be used to not completely undo what had been done. Of course, the privacy rule was required by HIPAA. So, and the other thing I just wanted to note was that there, particularly in healthcare under the ACA, there's just been, and I doubt that it's only under the ACA, there's just been an avalanche of sub-regulatory guidance, which I assume is much easier to change than, and it's significant, but it must be much easier to change than a rule. And
well,
I think
so
that's something that's different.
That. Oh, I just wanted to thank you for providing that example. Thanks for providing that. I think it's a good way to illustrate that there are ways to still influence those rules from a past administration via the rulemaking process, I guess, including the interim final rules, although I think there are some statutory prohibitions on when those can be used. There may be some situations in which current midnight regulations are eligible for that. Was there a second portion that was a question? I can't remember.
Well, no, I'm familiar with the requirements on interim final rules, but I'm just pointing out, too, that the Obama administration has been very keen on sub-regulatory guidance.
That's right, yes.
And,
yeah.
You would think, and there, the Administrative Procedure Act doesn't really talk about sub-regulatory guidance. I don't even know if there have been any litigation over sub-regulatory guidance, although it seems to, it probably does play a role like the Little Sisters of the Poor lawsuits, but, there's been a vast expansion of regulations through sub-regulatory guidance in this administration.
Yeah, and to my knowledge, it should be easy to revise the guidance. I think most guidance doesn't go through much of an official process where it needs to be, checking certain boxes from a statutory standpoint before it can be published. So my guess is that if there are troublesome guidance documents that are restricting certain types of activity, it would be much easier to turn attention to those. So thank you for bringing that up. I think that's a good example.
Adam,
thank
still,
you.
And
have, those are my comments. So thank you.
Adam,
well,
it's Dean. We have yet another question from the audience. Should we continue on? Two
sure
questions
enough
now.
Let's yes.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, hi. This is Vern Williams, and I was wondering if in situations like this where there's been a rule put in place and it may conflict with the 10th Amendment, the rights of the states, that a court process could be put in place to a lawsuit to hold that rule in abeyance until it gets adjudicated, and then give time for the regulatory process to fix the overstep by the current administration.
So just from, again, my knowledge of administrative law, people have tried to sue. I think you're discussing a situation where we don't have a final rule yet. And people have tried to step in during the rulemaking process if there have been sort of grave constitutional or even statutory concerns. And courts have usually been pretty reluctant to act on measures that aren't yet final. Of course, once the final rule hits the books, then you can certainly go ahead and pursue litigation. And this is actually an issue that Congress is trying to address now. There is, I think, Representative Marino from Pennsylvania has the Review Act, which would target only what they consider high-impact rules, so rules with $1 billion in impact. And that rule would allow a stay or an abeyance of that high-impact rule if a party filed suit within 60 days. But generally, as the system currently exists, you can't really do much when they're in the middle of the rulemaking process, and technically the agency hasn't officially acted.
Okay, I understand. So you can't take based on intent to violate the 10th Amendment, but you have to wait until there's actually been damage caused by congressional action or by regulatory action.
Yeah, and that goes to, from what I remember, the whole cases and controversies aspect of Article 3. You know, you have to have some sort of tangible reason, some sort of tangible harm. And obviously, if you're
shutting down coal plants and driving the price of electricity and putting people's lights out, sounds pretty harmful to me.
Yeah, and that's why people tried to bring litigation during the middle of the Clean Power Plan, and even I think a Congressional Review Act resolution during the middle of the Clean Power Plan. But you know, from the agency's perspective and from the administration's perspective, they say, well, the rulemaking is changing, it will probably change during the comment process, and nothing is final yet until we publish it. And even then, I think the agency might say, well, it doesn't technically go into effect until 2020, but courts have already offered some hope to people challenging, because we'll have a court case, I think, pretty soon, this fall, I believe.
That's right. The Clean Power Plan case is being heard before the en banc D.C. Circuit on, I believe, September 27th.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We have but a single question pending, about 12 minutes left. Let's take another call.
Yes, Joseph Bozowski from Plus Partners. My question actually was over, it continues on the last question and last caller, particularly regulatory agencies.
I'm sorry, Carl. Can you repeat your question?
Yes. It goes on about regulatory agencies as well as coal and nuclear power plants. Basically, what the Obama administration is poisoning changes to the, in particular, greenhouse energy and gas emissions. For instance, CERA Week, discussing how energy and power plants will have to address these 2030 guidelines and restrictions. And basically, what they're trying to do is put new policies and procedures in terms of coal plants, removing coal plants, and energy. And basically just wanted to talk about that briefly and how that's impacting not only natural gas suppliers but also energy and power plants.
Well, as if I may just jump in, as we mentioned, the Clean Power Plan, which is the source of a lot of this the regulatory requirements that are you're discussing about coal-fired power plants and others. That's the subject of a final rule, the Clean Power Plan, which is about to be litigated in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit on September 27th in a major case that'll be closely watched. As it happens, the Federal Society had an entire event dedicated to that at the National Press Club, I think, last week, and also a teleforum on that. I have to admit that getting into the details of the Clean Power Plan would be, and literally has been, a teleforum in and of itself. And so, Dean, if I could sort of politely, if we could just sort of politely sidestep that question and encourage listeners to tune in to the archived teleforum on the Clean Power Plan. I know they'll learn a lot from Mr. Rivkin and Mr. Bookbinder, who debated the subject.
Yeah, basically it was like Chesapeake Energy, they've gone from 50 wells now down to 8 or 10 because of this.
It's a major rule, and it's a good example of something that Sophie and Sam have alluded to, that there's some things that a president can do, you know, on his or her own very quickly to stop pending regulations. But once you have a final rule, as Sophie said, there's some things the president can do on his own, but there's also a lot that has to be done through notice and comment rulemaking, a process to unwind the rule that's already been established and finalized through notice and comment rulemaking. Sophie, is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, I think you've got the essence there, Adam.
If I may ask, Sam and Sophie, we said at the very outset in describing your biographies, you have very wide-ranging portfolios of research. And just for the caller's benefit, would you mind describing the other things that you're working on right now?
Sure. I'm, I think, like Sophie, also looking at midnight regulation, or I guess right now sort of twilight regulation, what's coming out of the Obama administration right now. We're also, I mentioned, you know, we've talked a lot about climate regulations, working on a big project analyzing what a regulation-only approach to climate change means. How would, you know, Secretary Clinton has pledged the 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by, I think, it's 2050 or 2040. And what would that look like from a regulatory approach? That's something we've been working on. And we've also spent some time recently looking at the Unfunded Mandates Reform Act and sort of the output of rules that contain unfunded mandates from one administration to the next, and maybe where this administration is in historical context.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing all of those products, Sam. And I want to thank you again for teeing up one of my favorite topics, which is energy efficiency. And I'll bring it up again because it's something that I do continue to work on. And if folks are interested in the idea of regulations restricting choices and what those effects may be for different populations, especially for low-income communities in the U.S., I do have a co-authored book chapter that's coming out shortly, being published by Palgrave Macmillan in their series on behavioral economics. It's co-authored with Brian Mannix. So keep your eyes peeled if that's a topic that you're interested in. Another couple areas that I'm interested in pursuing further, and I'm planning to do so, I've been looking at some of the regressive effects of regulation. So these regulations have different effects on different parts of the population. And when you restrict choices to people who have limited incomes, it can really increase prices for those people and restrict their opportunities. So that's something that I look at, particularly in the context of energy efficiency regulations. But then also, we're looking at how regulations can influence innovation and competition. So I'm sure many of you saw the DOT guidance that was recently released on driverless cars. What is that going to do to innovation? Are we going to be accelerating, pardon the pun intended, toward a future in which there are fewer traffic fatalities as a result of innovation? Or will this put a stop to some of that development? Will people feel like there are hurdles in the way of that innovation? So that's something that I'm keeping my eye on and that I encourage you all to do the same as well.
Well, all that sounds fascinating, especially for regulatory-minded folks like us who are joining in on the call. Do either of you have any thoughts in closing on the reports that we've been discussing today?
I'd like to thank the Federalist Society for inviting me to be a part of this. And thank you so much, Adam, for moderating. It was such a pleasure. And Sam, of course, I always appreciate hearing from you. I'll just end on the note of, if you're interested in what we talked about today about midnight regulations or any of the modeling that we conducted, I encourage you to go to the George Washington University Regulatory Studies Center's website to see some of our related research there.
Adam Dean, I echo that. Thanks again for putting this on. And if folks are interested, our information can be found at AmericanActionForum.org.
And let me just add that Sam and Sophie are two of the most prolific writers in Washington on regulation. And so I encourage everybody to look them up on their websites, AmericanActionForum.org, and at the George Washington University Regulatory Studies Center, where they both published a ton of very well-written and thoughtful analysis. And also, I'd encourage you to subscribe to the Regulatory Studies Center's weekly email digest, which really is packed with updates on what's happening in the agencies themselves and also in the think tanks and schools and journals that are following the agencies. It's really an indispensable resource. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dean to wind this down.
Very quickly, just my special thanks and thanks on behalf of the Federal Society to all three of our panelists and experts today. We certainly appreciate it. A thank you to the audience as well for dialing in and for your questions. A reminder to our audience about our next scheduled Teleform conference call. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. We'll be discussing midnight monuments. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.